Hi, I'm Binnie Klein. Matthew Clam is the author of a highly praised short story collection, Sam the Cat. He's received a Guggenheim, a Whiting Award, and an NEA grant. He writes for publications like The New Yorker and Harper's and The New York Times Magazine. And now, long awaited, 17 years after Sam the Cat, he has published another book. It's a novel this time, Who is Rich? I'm so glad I heard about it. It's funny and irreverent, but it's also very insightful and moving. And I happily, if guiltily, identified somewhat with the confused and rambunctious main character, Rich, who is on an unusual hero's journey of sorts. I was so delighted to have the opportunity for a long conversation with Clam. I asked him to begin with a bit of a plot summary.
Every year, a guy named Rich Fisher, who is a magazine illustrator, leaves his wife and two little kids behind to go teach a class on cartooning at an annual week-long summer arts conference by the beach in a beautiful place. A woman named Amy O'Donnell is the wife of a Wall Street billionaire and is herself the mother of three small kids and goes to the conference, or went the year before, to take a class on painting. She and Rich met and bonded over the shock at how their lives were turning out, and had a night of passion, and then spent the winter sending hot emails and texts back and forth, and now they're back. And about 50 or so pages into the book, on the first full day of the conference, there's the annual softball game. Amy trips and falls on second base and breaks her wrist, and they had sort of run into each other just before the game to kind of make sure the other one knew that they were safe, and that even though they'd both ended up at the conference, they were going to leave each other in peace, and that there wasn't going to be any more of this kind of anxiousness and flirtation that they'd been participating in all winter. And instead, he sort of sees her through the bone setting, and they have four sort of intense days after that in which their lives totally unravel.
Yeah, nice condensation. Doesn't do the book justice at all, because the thing is, the writing is so spot on and so hilarious. You know, there's all this talk in interviews with you, and even at the end of your book, you go into a nice description of this issue that preoccupies people of, you know, so is Rich an unreliable narrator? Well, I want to propose something different. I think he's very reliable. I identified with this man all throughout the book. His voice never wavers. He is bitter. He is lusting. He is jealous. He is reckless. I mean, but he never varies. And his depiction of the people at the conference, and that's what starts the book off in such an amusing way. And to those of us who have been to these types of conferences, it's so recognizable. But you had me at hello with the second paragraph on the page. Could you read that one?
Sure. Nada Klein, with her long French braid and dark wolfish eyes, walked through the tent with her shawl dragging on the ground. She beat cancer every year and showed up late to her own slide talks and was widely mocked and imitated. Larry Burris was back, too. He skipped his meds 1 year and wore a jester's cap to class and lit his own notes on fire and had to spend the night in a hospital. He stood beside me now, beneath the tent flap, patiently signing a copy of his book, and handed it back to a woman who hugged him. On the faculty were many friends I'd come to know over the years as intellects, historians, wordsmiths, talented performers, storytellers with big fake teeth, addicts, drunkards, perverts, world-famous womanizers, sufferers of gout, maniacs, liars, embittered, delusional, accomplished, scared of spiders, unable to swim, loveless, and cruel. I noticed Barney Angerman, who'd won the Pulitzer for drama the year I was born, and Tabitha Portenly, who'd written an acclaimed incest memoir. She was helping Barney through the breakfast line as he gripped her arm. This past winter, the conference director had asked me to name another cartoonist I could vouch for to teach a second comics workshop, but I didn't answer him. I worried, because of the way my career had gone, that I'd be hiring my replacement.
Matthew, can you guess which phrase I thought was the most transgressive?
Which was the most transgressive?
It's early on in the paragraph, and it's when I knew I was in good hands.
Was it what I made sure that you knew that Nada Klein let her shawl drag on the ground?
The next.
No, I'm just kidding.
No, you're close.
Uh-huh.
The next phrase.
She beat cancer every year?
Yeah, here's the thing. To me, now this is, of course, you know, we ought to be careful. No disrespect for people struggling with disease and all that, but there is something about the portrait of this woman in just those few lines, shawl dragging on the ground, she beat cancer, not just that year, but every year. I felt that was very good and wicked of you.
Well, you know, it is a funny thing how you get to know people who you see intensely, but just for, you know, for some people it's a few days, for some people it's a week at their annual vacation, for some people it's 2 weeks or a month. It's a strange kind of, it's the kind of thing you do when you sit next to someone on an airplane and you reveal all sorts of stuff about yourself that you wouldn't normally reveal because you just don't feel safe enough, maybe, or it just doesn't seem socially as acceptable to reveal so much personal stuff about yourself with someone you're going to see, you know, at the office or on your street or at the drop-off line when you drop your kid off at school. But there's something really intense about these annual sorts of things, and so he knows her pretty well, and in a way, it's almost easier to get to know people when you just know a slice of them. It's almost like, you know, taking the whole thing in at once is too much, but just knowing them for 2 weeks, you know enough to really know the person. Anyway, so, yeah, it's heartbreaking, but I think there's some empathy demonstrated for Nada Klein. She's, you know, he says her, that she's widely mocked and imitated. It's a community that knows its members pretty well. They reconvene every year, and they have their idiosyncrasies, and she's, you know, hers is sort of her forgetfulness, her inability to show up on time to her own public events is sort of the least of it.
And even her relentless survival.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. You have such a great power of observation for condensing people. You know, and that's the I'll call it the wickedness of Rich, is that he does that very glibly.
Well, I think it's part of his conflict. You know, I think throughout the book, there's a struggle in him, which is a struggle that a lot of us have, which is to make sense of how to write about the material that he knows the best. And he is someone who feels guilty, I think, because he sees so much so quickly in other people and can't stop having those insights. And I think it's one of the reasons why he's struggling. He feels a little guilty about the things he sees in other people, and he knows a certain truth. And it's certainly one of the reasons why I became a writer, I think, because my head was full of thoughts that didn't fit into the right boxes, maybe, and I needed a vessel to contain them. So anyway, he has, I think, a better than average ability to kind of assess people, and he is kind of cutting and caustic at times. He's a little bit dyspeptic, but he's also, you know, he's just a person who's full of strong feelings. He's full of strong feelings in positive and negative ways about the people around him, about the surroundings, about his sudden passion. He sort of falls in love for 3 or 4 days. He has sudden and strong feelings about his own children, about his wife, about his work, about art, about the weather at the beach, about the delicious food at the home of the billionaire who throws a party for the faculty every year.
Mm-hmm. That was an incredible scene. I mean, just, you know, and Rich has, and I think this is also partly a play on the title, he has a very, I don't know if you'd say, would you say ambivalent attitude towards people with money?
Well, sure. I mean, ambivalent is the diagnostically correct term or whatever it is, because he has strong feelings in both directions. And I think, you know, the conclusion that he's sort of working toward is, you know, that he knows one person, this billionaire, he knows her intimately, and he can see that it isn't magic to be super wealthy, which I think is sort of, I think is true, and I think it's helpful to him. But, you know, at the same time, he, like a lot of us, you know, could use a couple extra bucks, and it's sort of demonstrated throughout the book when he comes close to kind of destroying their finances through various madman activities, and, you know, you see it enters his mind like it would anybody, you know, that this whole sort of operation would be a little simpler if there was just a little more discretionary income.
It's also, I think, very candid and honest when he is lovers with Amy, who does have tons of money from her husband, who's an equity something or other, and she even is a trader. I don't know, but he begins to, in a feverish state and in a narcissistic state, he wants some of her money, and I just don't blame him at all. You know, he just it just feels like maybe he should be paid for this slavish adoration to this strange woman.
Well, you know, and it was one of the things that I sort of hoped that I got across. I kind of, I felt like I worked pretty hard to make Amy a full-blown three-dimensional character. She's somebody who grew up poor, one of six or seven kids, in a big family. The father died young. The parents were immigrants, and she sort of stepped sideways into finance, and suddenly she was making money, and then she was meeting this man who had so much, even more money than her. But she, her values are the same. She doesn't like to be ripped off. She doesn't want to pay anything extra for something that doesn't deserve to be paid extra for. So, for instance, he says at one point that she uses old bread bags as lunch bags when she takes her lunch wherever she goes, you know, and she, when he visits her at her mansion in Connecticut, he asks for a glass of water. She runs the tap, and she gives him a glass of water. And at the same time, she is driven to be an active and engaged philanthropist. And so it's, the book takes place in 2012. It's the summer of Romney running against Obama's second term, and the Fukushima nuclear reactor tsunami thing has happened not that long before that. She's pumped a lot of money into relief efforts there. She has education reform projects all over the world that she's working on, and she's hell-bent to fix sort of the suffering of the world with her wealth, which actually doesn't make her an easier mark to you know, hand over a big wad of cash to this guy who she happens to be having this fling with for a couple of days. It just doesn't enter her mind. You know, she, at one point she says to him, "You're not a school with 2,000 kids in it. You know, you're just a guy with really nice lips." And you can sort of understand her. You know, she's sort of saying, "I have a logic that I use in order to dispense this cash out into the world. I'm trying to make the world a better place." Dump, you know, and he even says that if he even got the courage to say to her, "Look, my finances are a wreck, and I don't even have enough money to send my kid to her last year of preschool, which costs $3,000, and he just wasted some of that money at the conference," he says, you know, it would be a really tasteless thing to do, that he'd feel like a bimbo if he asked her. And so he'd rather kind of maintain his dignity and just shut up and suck it up.
And you could sort of see that. Yeah, okay. Well, we have to keep it clean, by the way, since we're on live radio.
Did I say something?
I think you did. But, you know, I think people are, there was a word there. People are so used to the podcast format where it's not going out live under any rules of FCC. Listen, when I do the podcast, I'll edit it out. There'll be no problem. But I just thought I'd insert that that cautionary tale, because there is a lot in the book that is very raw, shall we say. Page 23. Since we're talking about the relationships, and I really appreciated that Amy and Robin, his wife, who some have referred to in interviews with you as his long-suffering wife, and I was struck by that his life at home, you know, with his kids wasn't so bad. Well, I didn't really agree. I really felt like I could see the deadness and the repetition and the kind of accommodation. And in that, I think you raise bigger issues than midlife about marriage and long-term relationships. And we can maybe get to that in a minute. But maybe this is a good way to describe a little bit of why he's so longing and so vulnerable. Page 23, where it starts, our sex life.
Do you want me to read that paragraph?
Would you mind?
Sure. No. Our sex life hadn't been mauled by depression, routine, or conflict as much as it had been mauled by distraction, diffusion, a surfeit of beauty. Was that it? Our children's vitality and strangeness, their softness, shocked me every day. Their lightness and willingness and spirit and stupidity surprised me. Their readiness to bravely step into a world they couldn't understand, packed with swimming pools, speeding cars, blazing sun, fanged dogs, stinging bees, heat, silent anger, slammed doors, inexplicable demands, funny hats slammed on their heads, and constantly from every direction, these giants with 12-pound heads, 10 times their weight, 5 times their height, grabbing, pushing, shoving past, talking loud, telling them how to think, what to want, how to treat their own impulses, which ones to kill, which ones to love. No to crawling inside a dishwasher or smacking your food when you chewed. Yes to climbing trees and sucking your toes. I was sad for the bleakness of a little kid's bumbling existence, envious of the simplicity of their cause. They faced the world because they had no choice. Someone was crying. Someone had pooped his pants. There were explorers in a new land. Robin and I stood by them in parallel formation to witness and guide them.
Actually, now I'm thinking if you could jump to the paragraph on the next page, the last paragraph, it will make a nice segue to the coupling of him and his wife.
The last paragraph on 24?
Yeah.
I'd never been able to beat back the loneliness of a solitary life, but as part of a couple, I felt invisible and deformed. And even at those times when I meant what I said, my words of affection had to be forced through sarcasm and shame. When I misbehaved, acted out discreetly, impulsively, I felt unbreakable and invincible, although, of course, the guilt eventually tore me apart. And sometimes I examined those parts, and sometimes I pushed them away, but that was just pushing myself away, the pure, monstrous reality, the real me, and without those parts, I was an empty shell. The longer it went on, the worse I felt, until I was out of control and panic seized me and I ran back home.
Hmm. So when he's at the conference, and I think you're right, they're sort of like a hotbed of pseudo-intimacy. I'm not sure exactly why. I guess it's because people are away. So I was at Breadloaf at a young age, and I did have an affair there, actually, full disclosure. But I wasn't married at the time.
Right.
And it sort of seemed like the thing to do. I mean, everything was so intense, and the ferociousness of the ambition was just like seething all around me.
Yeah.
And I was depressed and I was anxious and I didn't even really like the guy all that much.
Right.
But I could see, I mean, you really brought to life that people cleave to each other in those settings, right?
Well, you know, it's funny. I have a sort of answer.
Please, help me, help me, help me.
No, I mean, what I was going to say was that my answer, which I sort of worked on, which I'll say in a second, is not as good as what you just said. So what I would say is that when people go to a summer arts conference, it's a kind of summer camp for grown-ups, and your mortgage and your job, relationships at work, relationships with your neighbors, the concerns you have for the crack in the wall in your living room that needs to be repainted, all that stuff gets shoved to the side, and instead, for 5 or 10 days, there's just this intense focus on one thing that you love. I just want to get up on stage and read my poem. I just want to work on my painting, my craft, my get back into musical theater. But what's interesting is that we set aside that conventional persona, the one we create that helps us get through the world. And in its place, there is another self. And that's the one that's sort of thriving in that community, but it's actually not that easy to have that persona either. And that one is, I think, when you're saying, you know, I was depressed, I was anxious, I was excited, all these things. I mean, that feels a little bit more to me like the hell of being, you know, a teenager. And none of us want to go back there. It's really exciting. And any of us who have a front row seat to the lives of people who are in their, you know, teens and early 20s or whatever, we know, like, they're having a lot of fun. It's exciting. It's they're brave. They're foolish. They tumble headlong into things. They decide on a life track and then they toss it. And we're sitting in a place that's got, you know, some distance from them, but we're envious. And I think these conferences, they really bring out that part of you. And it's a necessary part of us that I think we don't have enough room for in our conventional lives. And which is why I think I'm not going to, I mean, it may not be the case, but I'm imagining that your experience at Breadloaf, good or bad, was sort of meaningful in some ways. And I think these sort of messy experiences are in some ways good, like a kind of spring cleaning for grown-ups, you know?
Oh, I love that line, a spring cleaning. Do you think in a way that self that you access there, that one does, is kind of like Jung's shadow?
Like Jung's what?
Shadow. You know,
I'm married to a psychoanalyst, but I don't actually
She's probably not a Jungian.
She's not. She knows a little bit about it, but and unfortunately, she's not here, so I could ask her. But
well, every good psychoanalyst, and I'm sure your wife is very good, knows a little about Jung. You know, that's
right.
Sort of the way it goes. I got a little bit more into him, maybe, than the usual because of the dream stuff, the dream analysis, and the poetry of it. But so the shadow is this denigrated part of the self, and that's why it's called the shadow. It's like the dark thing on the ground behind you. And I think it was one of his better concepts. Has to do with like the disavowed pile of stuff in the id primarily. And if it's not looked at and named, see, and this is why I really think Rich is such an important character. It's it grows more powerful, and it gets projected outward. You know, so his lofty goal as an analyst was to get the patient to integrate, own the shadow, you know, and sort of bring it, name it.
Well, it's funny because I have accessed this really sort of private and intimate material and. For this book, and there are times when I'm walking down the street, we have a puppy, and I'll see a neighbor, and a number of my neighbors have read this book now, and either they'll want to talk to me about it, or they'll just say one or two words about it, and I'll think, it's 7 o'clock in the morning, can I just walk the puppy? But there's definitely a part of myself that feels sort of violated, like, oh, I don't want to talk about that now, that's too private. I published a book about it. I obviously do want to talk about it, but I think it is my own clumsy way to attempt to integrate these parts of myself. And for the narrator in this book, he's in that same struggle. He has been functioning as a capable parent with a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old. The 1-year-old doesn't sleep, hasn't slept more than 2 hours in its entire life, the boy. The girl has just recently begun to sleep, but his wife works pretty much full time. He works pretty much full time. They're exhausted. They're doing their best, and because of that kind of, you know, task ridden life, they're not paying attention to other parts of themselves. And so that kind of, I mean, the midlife tag, it gets dropped so easily on this sort of dynamic. But the truth is, they're just trying to be human beings. You know, it's not that different from an 18 or 19 year old figuring out whether this is the right major for them and feeling like they don't belong in marketing. I mean, Jung was talking about something that it's hard for any of us to do, which is to maintain a full flowering engagement with the things that we love in life. And to feel most alive. I mean, I think for all of us, that's a struggle. It's a constant struggle. And it's an interesting sort of first world struggle among people I know, because we're so well fed, you know, we're not starving, even when for those of us who aren't wealthy or who are struggling in some ways financially, you know, the struggles are more sort of existential, and there are these choices we make, and it's an interesting kind of first world conflict.
I think you're absolutely right. I think marketing wise, perfectly fine to for the publicist to say, you know, or have your book be in the category of midlife crisis for a man.
Right.
But I actually think it's a lifelong struggle, as you said, because we have multiple selves. And
yeah.
The thing I wanted to say about marriage and ask you to talk about, sometimes it seems like we exchange in a long relationship the erotic tension and sort of differentiation for comfort.
Yeah, well, sure. I think, you know, for this narrator, there is a kind of there's just these sort of needs for survival. So nobody's sleeping in that house. You know, it's one of the least sexy kinds of states to be in when you're walking around sleep deprived. Some of the worst outfits in the world get assembled by people who are sleep deprived, and you just don't have time or energy. And it's not just time or energy. Your self-esteem takes a knock, and it doesn't quite get rebuilt right. I mean, at one point, the Robin, the wife of the narrator, says that she'd had two C-sections, and she felt like they put her back together wrong. And I think for a lot of us, we enter into these bigger commitments in life, marriage, parenting, deep debt for homeownership, and when we come out, we're not the same people. And we're sort of wondering, you know, where is, it's like that Joan Didion line, where is that girl who used to be me? Where is that person who used to be me? And that kind of heated, direct engagement with oneself, with one's own beauty and one's own body and one's own charisma and one's own zest for life, that stuff gets blunted or muted or, you know, pushed in a different direction. And sex is an easy, you know, a victim of that kind of, you know, falls to the wayside in one struggle to kind of keep, you know, one's identity in at least, you know, mostly functioning.
Yeah, and, you know, actually, as you're describing the situation that Rich and his wife, Robin, are in, with the kid who isn't sleeping and the little girl with her quirks and all that, it's not really an image of comfort. It's struggle. It's struggle, and it's sleep deprivation, and people can relate to it. I guess what I was thinking about by comfort was the comfort of, you know, being in your sweatpants around someone.
Sure.
That kind of thing, you know, that
sure.
doesn't really promote the kind of thing that Rich ultimately misses and longs for and finds in Amy, which is such a great character, because both of these women are, everyone's objectified. Even he is. I mean, what I really liked about him as a male character struggling with his sexuality and his longing is that he also wants to be objectified. Wants to. This is like the dirty secret that
he wants to be seen as irresistible. Yeah.
Irresistible.
And he wants to be in somebody's arms, just like anybody does. He wants to be thought of, you know, in those passionate terms. He likes the fact, I think. And he knows, you know, that Amy is really putting herself at risk to be with him, and he loves that idea. I think, you know, it's exciting.
But he says literally, quote, "I wanted her to want my body and call me beautiful."
Sure.
And I just think that's different than what we're used to reading from a male voice. You know? Do you know what I mean?
Sure. This morning I was. I was folding laundry with my 12-year-old daughter, and I said, "What's this?" And she said, "It's called a romper." And and I said, "Boys just aren't encouraged to wear such cute clothes. We're not allowed to wear rompers, but we're, you know, by that same that idea of adorning the male. I mean, it's not as much encouraged, and so, I mean, yeah, and I think this guy has a pretty strong recollection of when he did feel, you know, like he was physically at his best and most attractive, and I think all of us can sort of remember that moment. We hope it's now, but we're pretty sure it's not, and he wants that again, and he has flashes of that with Amy, and it's, you know, I mean, I think I worked pretty hard to try to show that has, you know, that this idea of a kind of, you know, this fantasy person you project so much onto them, a lot of it isn't actually real, but there is something really powerful about intense connections. You know, I mean, I think one of the things that somebody was asking me in another interview, something like, "So you're all for adultery," or something like that, and I was like, "Oh, geez, that's not really what I meant at all." But I did want to say that I think it's important for us to love the things that we love, and if it just so happens that you have, you know, a neighbor or a colleague who you can't take your eyes off them, that's probably, it's not something that should be entirely, you know, burned out of a person. It's probably a source of something good if you can only figure out a way to express it so that it doesn't destroy your life. And for some people that might be, you know, a really hot 18 hours in a hotel room. For other people it might just be that, you know, weird kind of very sometimes nurturing, you know, friendship that's got something else, you know, another element to it. It's a kind of a beautiful thing. I mean, I definitely have, I never feel like I have enough people around me who I adore and who adore me. I want more, but I have a few, and they're really important to me, and I think everybody should have those, and it's a confusing thing. I mean, it's funny that when I was younger and I started, and my friends started dating and having long-term girlfriends and boyfriends and relationships, it was actually easier to have friends of the opposite sex than it is now. It's like all of the treasure that's involved in the monogamous nuclear family make it more dangerous, or we become more fearful to just have friends who we have a little bit of a flirtation with or something. I mean, I was better at having, you know, women friends when I was 23 than I am now, in a way. It's funny.
Oh, I totally agree with that. Yeah, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. I miss someone looking at me with a certain kind of hunger and longing. Being very honest here, doctor, and I don't know that that's coming back.
Yeah.
And
well,
go ahead.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think, you know, that you know, charisma and a lust for life are really alluring attributes, and for anybody who is excited about, you know, certain elements in their life, you know, and they transmit that, that is sort of magnetic, you know. So
I still have it, potentially. I still have it.
You have it. You definitely have it. No, I'm saying, yeah, and I'm saying that you should, you know, I guess not, maybe to think of it in the terms that we thought of when we were 16 is wrong, but to make note of that power when you see it in other people's eyes, when you see that they are excited.
Yeah, but, you know, it's almost like I had to beg to hear you say that. Like, I just, you know, I had to bring it up. And then you said it, and now that feels good, but...
It is a funny thing, though, and I think it's harder, obviously. I think it is probably harder for women because it's, I mean, you know, it's just the terms are so different. I mean, I'm already looking at, you know, in my preteen daughter, you know, the boys go around dressed in these, you know, ugly, shiny workout clothes. Mm. And the girls, starting at age 9 and probably before that, are working on looking, I mean, they don't go around in those clothes. And the so it's, you know, the female, you know, power of attraction or whatever, that whole physical realm. I think it's just different for boys and girls, and I think I could understand how from, you know, for any of us, but I think men have an easier time of excusing feeling marginalized as they get older. For women, I think it's more direct, or it feels more direct, but
I see what you mean. Mm-hmm.
But my experience as a professor, you know, at Johns Hopkins for the last 8 years, sitting in a room full of 19-year-olds, I mean, I might as well be 170 years old. I mean, I started teaching there when I was 47 or whatever, and I was as old as some of their parents, and of a completely different species, you know?
That's brilliant. I know every year, I live near the New Haven area, the new crop of Yale students comes, and they look like they're 10. I mean, I don't understand. So we're talking with Matthew Clam, author of Who is Rich? And, you know, you're not advocating adultery. I mean, thoughts are not actions. We know this. Your wife knows this in her work. And Freud was very big on that. You know, it's okay. Don't feel guilty. It's just a thought. It's not an action. But fantasies.
Well, I think even more that you know, a psychoanalyst sort of knows that to embrace the fantasy is probably a much better and healthier alternative than to repress the fantasy.
Well, I guess so. Although I think sometimes if you indulge in too in sort of soupy, intoxicated a way, you can get sort of thrown off. But that's just a matter of degree. But I know what you mean. Like repression is probably goes back to the shadow, and then it just builds up, and then you explode. But fantasies enacted do have a life of their own, and you can't really predict the ripples. So it's sort of like moving objects 1 inch to the right, everything shifts. What's great about your novel is that Rich goes for it. And this is what, you know, for some readers makes him unlikable or something, that he's, you know, selfish or not thinking of his wife. But he allows you, in a way, to live a bit vicariously through him. And what's great is, it's not waves crashing on the shore and perfect bodies and the clothes just fall away. His lover, Amy, has a broken arm. She's in a hospital bed. He takes some of her drugs. It's awkward. It's hilarious. I mean, it really is. It really is. I really like this character, Rich.
Well, thanks. I mean, I felt, you know, that I had a lot of very positive associations with sex, and I wanted to make sure that I wasn't that I was portraying some of that. I wanted to, and I also wanted people to not feel castigated about having impulses, you know, physical impulses, and to be able to experience you know, there's like three or four sex scenes, and to have them be beautiful was one of my goals. I mean, I wanted them to be honest too, but I did. I wanted them to be beautiful. I wanted people to feel that they weren't turned off by sex.
I was just looking at sort of towards the end of the book, because he does return to Robin, to his wife, and it's not like a hazy going off into the sunset perfection. Because I was sort of afraid, I got nervous as the book progressed, that the resolution was going to be family's everything. Yeah. You know, actually, one interviewer did say something to you like, and it was a great interview, they've all been great, but he said something like, so in the end, you really celebrate the beauty of children. I didn't think that was really where you went.
I mean, I think, you know, the thing that he's celebrating at the end is the beauty of that place. And I think he's also feeling...
What place? Sort of, what place?
You know, the beach. I mean, I think he has a sort of beautiful moment there, you know, in the closing pages of the book, where he's just experiencing this gorgeous piece of, you know, East Coast, sea coast, in the absolute most beautiful part of the summer. And his senses are alive, and his endorphins are, you know, jacked up because he's been having awesome sex for 4 days, and he's been madly in love. I mean, I think it's all sort of swimming inside him. He He also has the best conversation with his wife at the pretty much the end of the book, where you realize they have a real relationship and that they're talking about, you know, their work and the logistics of their marriage, you know, and the and running the house and stuff like that, but that, you know, they know each other. And I think that I'm not sort of making any argument. I don't think I'm making any great argument for or against, but I think, you know, one of the beautiful things about their marriage is that they actually know each other and that he didn't leave, you know, that they stuck together. I think there's a lot of points, you know, that get awarded just for sticking around.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And I love the way they're like in a foxhole together, surviving the war. You know, like when in the morning or when he comes home, and I don't know which, but she tells him what it was like overnight with the kids. And it's like the reportage of a battle. You know, and then he cried for 7 hours, and then I did this. And you can, and you want to hear, like, you want to hear the details because the love, you know, is so strong.
Yeah.
And the and sort of the fascination for the details that only a couple could have about, you know, their baby's poop.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't even know if he exactly knows what love is. I think he's sort of, in a lot of ways, it, you know, in life, on the outside looking in, I think it's what makes him a good observer. But I'm not sure he even understands himself. You know, there is that element of, you know, you were saying that other reviewers were saying that this is something about an unreliable narrator. I mean, when he recounts earlier on in the book how he sort of came to be closely and intensely, you know, kind of in pursuit of Robin, he can't even be sure himself why he's doing it other than that he's so attracted to her. But he finds, you know, at a couple different places in the book, he says he finds that, you know, he really notices when she's not around and that he waits for her to come home. He talks about knowing her proclivities, almost like joining a certain cult that has all these certain kind of demands that are required of a person who's a member of that cult, and he sort of signs up as a member of her, the cult of Robin. He also, you know, speaks about her, I think, in ways, and she was a war TV journalist who went, you know, all over Latin America and saw mudslides and coups and earthquakes and prison fires and all kinds of tragedies, and he knows the details of her life intimately. And it really occurred to me at certain points, I was so worried. I wanted to make sure that the reader knew, that he knew, he really knew who she was and admired her bravery and her skill. And I think that that's a big part of, like, his kind of discussion of her background and what she's made of and what she's lived through.
Yeah.
But I also wondered during that whole time, I mean, I couldn't help but wonder whether I actually knew that much about my own wife's life. I mean, I think it is a funny kind of thing that we live right alongside these other people and we maybe don't know what they do every hour of the day. And
you know what? That's a really interesting question. And another interesting question that a colleague posed to me recently that got me thinking was, let me see if I can say this concisely. So you're with a person a really long time, and this is it. This is your adult development section. Like, you only get one shot. Yeah, so there's your childhood, right? And then, but this is it. And how did being with that one person affect the stages of your adult developmental life? Like, who could you have been? If, let's say, who could Rich have been if he did go off with Amy? Who knows what he would have learned if he would have grown more? But, like, the other day, I'm, like, sitting in my living room, you know, where we watch TV, and that's a big memory for me of childhood. Growing up in Newark was our little, it was lower middle class, little apartments, nothing great. But it has an image of comfort and home. The flowered couch, daddy's chair, you know, stuff like that. And so I was in my current living room and thinking, this is my adult couch. This is the man. This is the, you know, sounds like a nursery rhyme. This is, what is that one? I don't know. But this is the man. This is the couch. This is the TV. Yeah. What happened? Where? What? You know, so that's something I'd like to think more about. Maybe. I mean, because lest I sound like someone who's saying, oh, my God, I miss the excitement and all that. The comfort and the nurturance is amazing. And the piece of work that a long marriage is like Michelangelo's ceiling. You know, if you really work at it, I'm sure you and your wife do. I can tell.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, he admits sort of maybe grudgingly and certainly not in great detail, but, you know, he admits that, you know, it was good at least half the time. And you can assume that it was probably much more than that. And but I think he's getting a lot out of this sort of this kind of book length complaint about marriage, because it keeps him, well, he's trying to figure out what it all means and how it could possibly be useful in a story, and I think comfort and complacency don't play well in a narrative, and I think that is a sort of curse of a storyteller, someone who's, you know, actually being forced to in some ways gin up drama to make a story make sense. And he struggles with that very question, which is, am I making trouble for myself in order to make my life seem more worthwhile as a subject for a story?
And you know, the question of how much do we get to have? Maybe that sounds a little bit moralistic, but how happy are we entitled to be? How much acting out are we allowed to do to try to express these different selves? But any and all these questions are explored and evoked in what is really, really seriously a brilliant piece of writing that I enjoyed from start to finish. And it's so gratifying because I got Facebook on the screen and somebody just wrote, great interview, compelling, not easy stuff, I think, but definitely recognizable, made me want to go get the book and read it.
Well, that's great.
Isn't that great? I mean, that's just such a good feeling. I had one other question, and then we got to go, which is that the character is, there were so many ways I could have taken the interview, but we went with whatever. But the character is a cartoonist. And two things. Are you someone that follows cartoons or graphic novels a lot and really likes them? And then the other question is, you do have, I'm sure your editors have told you this, astonishing powers of observation. Like when you describe in one or two sentences the characters at the arts conference, you have a great way of listing things, this I really enjoyed, that could be a list of a lot of negatives and then there's a positive, or vice versa. A lot of positives and then this like, ba-dum, kind of negative. Love that. Do you think that inhabiting the character of a cartoonist made you look more visually and that contributed to the way you wrote? Does that make sense?
I think what happened was I realized from interviews, I took a class not unlike the class this guy teaches, as a sort of on a lark. I went up to White River Junction in Vermont and went to the Center of Cartoon Studies for 5 days and did a cartooning intensive. And I was talking to the teacher there, this guy named Jason Lutz, Lutes. He's an accomplished graphic novelist and a really great guy. And we were talking, and I realized that the way he talked and the way he worked sounded not that different from the way I worked as a fiction writer writing short stories at the time. And I thought that it wasn't that different. I think a lot of the work, journalists are sort of participate in this in the same sort of way, which is, you know, if you're quiet and you sit back, you can observe some pretty amazing stuff. It doesn't seem to be that much different. Although I was, you know, there was some question about like how to describe issues of drawing, but the actual sort of work of observing the stuff around us, you know, it's hard to do because we tend to kind of go through our lives a little bit less than fully conscious. And so I think there were times, I have a natural kind of bent in that direction, you know, to observe and to make quick observations and then to be sort of aghast at what I just realized was the truth and then not know what to do with it and then hang around with it, maybe write it down, and then someday it might appear in my work.
Thank you, Matthew Clown. This has been wonderful.
Thank you, Benny.
Okay, so rock on. I think you're on a roll. I heard there's another book.
I'm actually heading out in 2 days to move to L.A. alone for a few months to work on a TV show. That's my next project.
You're a
wild man.
It's
not my TV show. It's a friend's TV show, but I'm going to learn a little bit about the TV world writing then. So,
many selves, many selves.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for all your compliments and for reading the book so carefully and for inviting me on your show.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.